Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
Well, I'm Ken Rudin, but Ron, you have a very stern face on
today. I do. I'm feeling that this particular political season has begun to take a very serious turn.
Is it because you're very excited about the Vermont and Rhode Island primary?
The two primaries in those often overlooked parts of Red Sox Nation are going to contribute a little over 50 delegates to this more than 4,000 delegate convention in August in Denver.
And I guess, you know, as Rhode Island goes, so goes Vermont.
Four primaries are just around the corner: Texas, Ohio, Rhode Island, and Vermont. And Ken, which of those is going to be the most pivotal?
I would say Ohio. And the reason I say Ohio is because it looks like Barack Obama has maybe moved into a statistical tie with Hillary Clinton.
Statistical tie. Yes, in Texas.
But
that means he'll get more delegates, doesn't
he? He may get more delegates because of their interesting primary slash caucus, one of those monster movies.
It's a hybrid.
Yeah.
They vote in the daytime and they caucus at night.
Right. I've been doing that for years until they got arrested.
Yes, yeah.
But so Ohio, look, she had a 20-point lead perhaps a week or two ago, and now it's down to maybe anywhere between 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17.
I've actually seen Ohio polls now down to middle single digits, 5 or 6 points.
Oh, I have not.
Which is a third of where she was a month ago, which is 10 points down from where she was 10 days ago. She is rapidly losing that lead in Ohio, but it's really Texas, I think, that is becoming the mountain for her to climb. If she doesn't win both Texas and Ohio, she's going to be in an extraordinarily weakened condition and remaining there for the rest of this contest as long as she chooses to continue.
Oh, so you're saying Texas. I'm saying Ohio, because she's got to win that. If she doesn't, she's dead. But what could happen in Texas is that there could be a sizable difference in delegates for Barack Obama. No matter who wins the popular vote, theoretically Hillary Clinton could perhaps win the popular vote, but not come away with the most delegates because of this hybrid system.
And then in Ohio, where it'll presumably be close, then she will get more delegates than Barack in that one state, but not by very many, again, because the rules work against her. Add to that the delegates he's likely to pick up in Vermont and Rhode Island, although Rhode Island is closer than Vermont. And it's going to be another day in which he comes away with a lot more delegates, even if she manages to hold on and win in Ohio.
Yeah. Now, I mean, I always thought from the beginning, even if she wins Texas and Ohio, I mean, the headlines would say Hillary Clinton wins Texas and Ohio, which is big.
Breaks up the winning streak.
But if she wins Ohio 52-48, 53-47, she still may only net 5 or 6 delegates, and that's
way less than he'll get in Texas.
Right. And that's not going to get her to the magic number of 2025.
And on the superdelegate front, Ken, a development this week: John Lewis has made it official. He is leaving the Hillary Clinton camp as the superdelegate from Atlanta, Georgia. He is a very important superdelegate.
There are many African-American supporters of Hillary Clinton who committed early. They liked the fact that she was so-called inevitable. She was certainly a front-runner. They want to get on board with her. The fact that he broke — usually superdelegates don't break.
Not publicly.
They endorse, and if they made a mistake, they just have to sit and suffer with it.
They just keep their mouth shut until the convention.
But Lewis, I mean, by saying that there's a movement in this country that I cannot ignore any longer, that's almost more devastating to the Clinton campaign than anything else that could happen this week.
Ken Rudin, I think I should congratulate you, because I think you almost uniquely in American journalism have resisted this mythical appeal of Barack Obama. You were not part of the target for Hillary Clinton's attack on the media's supposed bias in their last debate that was on MSNBC this week. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Can I just point out that in the last several debates, I seem to get the first question all the time, and I don't mind. I'll be happy to field them, but I do find it curious. And if anybody saw Saturday Night Live, you know, maybe we should ask Barack if he's comfortable and needs another pillow. I just find it kind of curious that I keep getting the first question on all of these issues, but I'm happy to answer it.
First of all, there's a second debate in a row where obviously she came with a prepared line. The last one was the Xerox speech, which I think fell flat. This was very bizarre. First of all, why would she object to getting the first question? If I was somebody like that, I would love to lead the debate, lead the dialogue, the discussion, by answering it the way I feel fit.
All through the debates last year, when we had many — this, of course, was the 20th debate in which these two candidates were part — All through those Democratic debates, when she would be questioned first, it was a kind of acknowledgement that she was the clear front runner and it was the queen in her court. So, of course, you went to her first.
And nobody had a debate better than she did. I mean, she was solid on the issues. She ignored her Democratic rivals, kept looking at George Bush and the Republicans. And I thought very effective until the doubts began to seep in about her candidacy, starting perhaps last October with the Philadelphia debate and the Tim Russert questions about driver's licenses for legal immigrants.
Still not a bad performance on her part by any means. I mean, there were flaws, and there were a couple of stumbling answers for the first time all year. But apart from that, it was a good performance.
But this seemed one of those woe is me type thing. You know, I know you're asking me the question first. Why is that negative? And how does that, what makes her mind immediately go to the Saturday Night Live skit, which was, of course, it was funny, the fact that the media fawns all over Barack Obama and they don't ask him tough questions and they're wooed by his rhetoric and his hope, message of hope.
Yeah, it was funny. It was funny stuff. But for her to try to pick up on that and make a point of it in the debate, almost at the very beginning of the debate, right after the long discussion of their health care plans,
16 minutes.
One could sense that this was something that was really gnawing at her and something that she wanted to go to immediately.
But again, it seemed like tactics. And I know the listener doesn't like the fact that we all often talk about tactics. They like about issues.
Yes, substance. Yeah, yeah.
I really care about substance.
The listener cares about substance.
He does.
Yes.
She does.
All right. Later on in the debate, there was another moment that got replayed a lot after the debate. And that was the moment when Tim Russert, who was obviously playing the pit bull again in this debate, as he does on Sunday morning.
Does it better than anybody else.
To both candidates, went after Barack Obama on the highly sensitive issue of his relationship, or at least the backing he's been given by the controversial minister, Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam.
On Sunday, the headline in your hometown paper, Chicago Tribune, Louis Farrakhan backs Obama for president at Nation of Islam convention in Chicago. Do you accept the support of Louis Farrakhan?
You know, I have been very clear in my denunciation of Minister Farrakhan's anti-Semitic comments. I think they are unacceptable and reprehensible. I did not solicit this support. He expressed pride in an African-American who seems to be bringing the country together. I obviously can't censor him, but it is not support that I sought, and we're not doing anything, I assure you, formally or informally with Minister Farrakhan.
Do you reject his support?
Well, Tim, you know, I can't say to somebody that he can't say that he thinks I'm a good guy. I have been very clear in my denunciations of him and his past statements, and I think that indicates to the American people what my stance is on those comments.
It was not as confident an answer as Barack Obama might have wanted to give to this question.
Well, there is a balancing act that Barack Obama has had to go through, and that is appealing to Jewish voters. And, of course, you mentioned the name Louis Farrakhan, and Jewish voters go understandably ballistic, given the things he's said in the past. But also, I mean, I know what you're saying, that you feel that perhaps Barack Obama did not give a confident answer to it. But at the same time, my reaction to it was that I think it's disingenuous of white journalists and white politicians to constantly give African-American politicians this litmus test that they've got to denounce Louis Farrakhan or otherwise they're, you know, they're anti-Semitic or racist.
I can imagine these questions coming up, and you would think that people would be prepared with very certain answers, very crisp answers, such as, no, I don't accept that support. Yes, I reject that support.
But I kind of thought that he ended on a stronger term than he was when he got into it.
After Clinton said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll reject everything he's ever said. And then Obama came back and said, all right, if you prefer the word reject to denounce, fine, I reject it and I denounce it. And that finally was the end of that. There's been a lot of news on the Obama front this week. John McCain took off after him.
Wisely, I suspect. The Republican campaign is now focusing their attention on Barack Obama. Because if you remember, and we've talked about this many times, during all the debates of 2007 and early 2008, what united the Republican Party was the thought that Hillary Clinton would be the nominee, and now it's no longer the case.
But they're prepared to shift their sights and go after Barack Obama. And we saw some of that this week as well, as John McCain quoted Barack Obama from the debate, saying he would do certain things to guarantee that al-Qaeda would not get a strong foothold in Iraq. And this was how John McCain came back.
I have some news. Al-Qaeda is in Iraq. Al-Qaeda, it's called Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
And then Barack Obama responded by saying,
I have some news for John McCain, and that is that there was no such thing as al-Qaeda in Iraq until George Bush and John McCain decided to invade Iraq.
Some not-so-subtle shifts are going on here. John McCain has shifted to attacking Barack Obama as the new presumptive frontrunner, not Hillary Clinton anymore. And Barack Obama is suddenly shifting from blaming Hillary Clinton for the war in Iraq to blaming John McCain.
Plus the fact that Barack Obama knows that the Democratic Party goes into any fall general election campaign at a disadvantage on national security, on war-related issues, and he's not going to let the Republicans do what John Kerry apparently let them do and just respond too late. Without any hesitation, Barack Obama responded to John McCain. His target has always been Hillary Clinton on that because she voted for the war, and of course Barack Obama spoke out against it, but now he's easily adapted that criticism to include John McCain.
So this campaign has now been going on. These primaries have been going on really not just since Iowa and New Hampshire, but really all the way back through 2007. And we stand now poised at the brink of what could be the conclusion. At least one party ought to determine who its nominee is on March 4th. Can John McCain lock it up that day?
Well, he certainly is on his way. I mean, we did see an impressive 37% that Mike Huckabee won in Wisconsin, and there are certainly more social conservatives, I suspect, in Texas than there are in Wisconsin. But he's on the way to the nomination. I think the flap with the New York Times may have helped him, may have helped rally conservatives around him. So, I mean, these are not winner-take-all states. They are winner-take-all by congressional district.
So he could theoretically take the lion's share, as he did in California, a similar arrangement.
Right, and 1,191 is looking very, very close. Mike Huckabee has said he will not leave until it's time for him to leave. And let's see what happens on March 4th, but that could be the time for him to leave.
McCain is opening a pretty good lead in both Texas and Ohio, but does he still have a sale to make to conservatives? I think John McCain has sold an awful lot of people on this candidacy, even people who were hesitant to embrace it. But you still see these incidents rise up. For example, when he came to Cincinnati, Ohio, and he was introduced by very straight, moderate, staid guy, Rob Portman, who's been the OMB director and who's been a congressman.
Possible VP?
Has been mentioned as a possible VP.
You heard it here first.
And then out they bring a radio personality, and you always have to watch out for radio personalities.
Tell me about it.
Named Bill Cunningham. Let's listen to a little bit of what Bill said to warm up the crowd for John McCain.
It's going to be Barack Hussein Obama's wonderful life a year from today. It's about February the 26th, 2009. Barack Obama is in the White House. Obama just came back from meeting with Ahmadinejad. He's got a meeting the next week with Kim Jong-il in North Korea. Then he's going to saddle up next to Hezbollah. They're going to have a little cookie and cream party. All's going to be right with the world when the great prophet from Chicago takes the stand, and the world leaders who want to kill us will simply be singing Kumbaya together around the table of Barack Obama. It's all going to be great.
So after Mr. Cunningham had made his presentation, John McCain apparently did not hear it but was informed about it, and he wanted to let the traveling press corps with him know this, and this is what he had to say.
I have repeatedly stated of my respect for Senator Obama and Senator Clinton, that I will treat them with respect. I will call them senator. We will have respectful debate. I regret any comments that may be made about these two individuals who are honorable Americans.
Which, of course, made Mr. Cunningham mad. And then he went out and said, well, if he's going to act like that, well, you know, maybe I'll endorse Hillary Clinton.
He may have alienated one more conservative.
Talk show host.
Well, you know, I don't know what that means. And I never heard of this person before. And I know he used to play for the Philadelphia 76ers.
But apart from that,
is that the same Billy Cunningham?
It's not. Okay. But it is another instance in which he finds himself putting down a strong conservative voice, another Rush Limbaugh, another Ann Coulter, another Glenn Beck, somebody who is going to say, I don't want to have anything to do with John McCain, and discouraging their listeners from having anything to do with John McCain, more importantly.
Yeah, and that's, again, the balancing act he has to do, because ultimately, when it comes to the general election, he's going to have to go after this huge amount of independents, Republican-leaning independents, who would love to vote GOP, and obviously it would be more difficult for them if, at the same time, he has to be very wary of his own right-wing flank.
There is a poll out this week that shows that if Barack Obama is the nominee of the Democratic Party, some 20% of the white Democrats questioned by this poll indicate that they would switch over and vote for McCain. So Democrats or independents who don't like Barack Obama for whatever reason would be susceptible of John McCain's appeal. He doesn't want to lose his appeal to that group by going too far with reference to this other group. But it does leave him at odds with the most intense, most profound conservative movement in America, who have been numerous in the last 30 years, really going back to the rise of Ronald Reagan. And I bring this up because we want to salute the passing of an individual who was, as much as anyone, responsible for the intellectual genesis of that movement, and that, of course, was William F. Buckley.
You know, when we were younger, I mean, there was not many conservatives. Right now, the conservative movement, perhaps embodied by Ronald Reagan's victory in 1980, back then there weren't that many conservatives, certainly not on the air. Certainly, I mean, now you have every radio talk show host now seems to be very conservative. But William F. Buckley was the only one. I mean, he wrote God and Family at Yale.
God and Man at Yale. That was all in the title, God and Man at Yale.
He wrote God
in the early 1950s.
1951.
He defended Joseph McCarthy.
Joe McCarthy, the great ventriloquist.
He wrote a number of books which, while
McCarthy
they were,
and His Enemies with Brent Bozell in 1955.
Right. And while he wrote these books in defense of very conservative figures and icons of the right, he always did it with a kind of dazzling wit and scintillating argumentative brilliance that made him welcome in the national conversation in a way that many other conservative commentators just weren't in the 50s and 60s. Interesting thing to note about him, he supported the transfer of the right to the Panama Canal to Panama in 1976 and debated Ronald Reagan on public television on that issue, taking the side that it was a good thing to transfer that.
And actually, now that I didn't expect you to talk about that, but what I remember about that is that Ronald Reagan seemed extremely informed and
informed and articulate.
This was, of course, in between his losing 1976 campaign and his victory in 1980. And I remember thinking everybody, a lot of Democrats would always say that he's just an actor, he's not that smart. But he seemed very sharp in that debate. Of course, Buckley always seemed sharp, but Reagan did too. And I do remember that debate, thinking there's more to Ronald Reagan than meets the eye.
One other thing that we should note about Bill Buckley was that he was a very funny man. And when he was running for mayor of New York, he was asked, what would he do if he actually won?
That's right. And his famous answer was, I would demand a recount.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/elections.
I'm Ron Ilvey.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Ron Ilvey, who the two candidates that William F. Buckley ran against for mayor of New York City in 1965?
John Lindsay.
That's correct.
And Procaccino?
No. I think he was anti-Caccino. It was Abe Beam.
Abe Beam, of course. Of course, the Democrat.
I remember he had a great slogan, vote for Beam. I remember that.
Well, thanks for joining us, Ken.
Okay. Well, look, I know when it's time to leave, and I appreciate that you having me here today, Ron.
Thank you for stopping by.
You bet. Thanks so much. Okay. It's really great. I really enjoyed the show a lot.
It was good having you.
Thanks, Ron. What's that music?
Thank you, Ken.
Oh, sounds like the Oscars.